Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Joe Hill, an organizer with the Occupy Wall Street protest encampment, who talks about the origins and future direction of what appears to be the foundation of a new national economic and social justice movement. Amy Fedig with the American Civil Liberties Union, who discusses the inhumane conditions at Pelican Bay Supermax Prison in California that has provoked a growing inmate hunger strike. And Richard Dieter of the Death Penalty Information Center, who explains why he believes the recent debate and protests opposing the execution of Troy Davis could strengthen the movement to abolish the death penalty in the U.S. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A week after a brutal police crackdown, indigenous activists in Bolivia restarted their long march to protest the construction of a road through the Isaboro-Sucre National Park and indigenous territory. In late September, 500 Bolivian police swooped down to break up the month-long march in the town of Yocumo. TV crews filmed dramatic images of women with their hands tied and tape across their mouths. The crackdown initiated a political crisis for Bolivian President Evo Morales, the South American country's first indigenous leader. Giant protests in La Paz and other big cities broke out to denounce police violence. Morales quickly suspended the construction of the road financed by Brazil, and the defense and interior ministers resigned. After the bloody incident, Morales, who announced his support for the road in 2010, issued a statement declaring, "I could never order such violence as seen by the Bolivian people." He then called for a local referendum to decide the fate of the controversial road. The road, which would connect Brazil's Atlantic coast to the Pacific coast in Peru, will cut through over 1 million hectares of national park and indigenous land in Bolivia. The clampdown on illegal immigration has become a huge global profit opportunity for private prison and security corporations. Governments in the United States, England, and Australia have relied heavily on these companies to detain growing numbers of undocumented immigrants. According to the New York Times, a growing list of firms, including Florida-based Geo Group, G4S, an Anglo-Dutch security company, and Serco, have won lucrative detention contracts but have a poor record on respecting the rights of detainees. Geo Group was found to have mistreated children. G4S was discovered to have abused detainees in solitary confinement. Serco has a record of dangerous overcrowding, ill-trained employees, and it has not hired adequate staff to monitor detainees. In the United States, for-profit prison corporations handle over 200,000 immigrant detainees a year, compared to only 8% of the state and federal inmate population. But immigrant rights and community activists are now pushing back against the aggressive marketing by for-profit detention centers. A new for-profit prison divestment campaign was launched in 2010, targeting big investors in Geo Group and the Corrections Corporation of America, or CCA. The campaign, led by Enlace Institute, a coalition of 21 worker and community groups in the United States and Mexico, convinced a New York hedge fund, Pershing Square Capital Management, to sell its shares of CCA. Other large investors like Wells Fargo, Fidelity Investments, and BlackRock continue to maintain big stakes in for-profit prison companies. In the wake of the January shooting of 13 people in Tucson that severely injured Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, Arizona state lawmakers saw no reason to retreat from their pro-gun ideology. In the past 6 months, the Republican-controlled state legislature overrode local ordinances banning guns from city parks and allowed guns into bars. Only a veto by Republican Governor Jan Brewer prevented even more extreme gun laws from passing, including a measure permitting guns on college campuses and in public buildings. Since the 1970s, Arizona has become a center for opposition to gun control laws. The state constitution, written in 1910, declares the right to bear arms in self-defense. According to the Tucson Weekly, former Arizona County Sheriff Richard Mack fought a court case against the 1994 Brady handgun law, which established a database for criminal background checks, asserting it was unconstitutional for local law enforcement to run criminal background checks on gun buyers. Today, Mack is a Tea Party activist and a firebrand defender of gun rights. Mack, like many Second Amendment advocates, claims he could have saved lives if he was at the Tucson shooting spree by Jared Lee Loeffner, now in psychiatric treatment in a federal prison hospital. Phoenix State Senator Steve Gallardo filed a bill to screen gun show buyers for those under 18, the mentally ill, and people with criminal records. But the bill never got a vote in the state Senate's Judiciary Committee. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
As the Occupy Wall Street protest encampment entered its third week in Lower Manhattan, activists there launched a march over the Brooklyn Bridge on October 1st that resulted in the arrest of 700 people. Although the New York City police say they warned protesters over bullhorns that marching onto the iconic bridge's roadway was illegal, eyewitnesses accused police of leading hundreds into the car lanes before moving in to make mass arrests. Whatever the original intent, the police crackdown on the Occupy Wall Street activists, including the documented earlier unprovoked pepper spraying of protesters, has given the action widespread and mostly positive publicity across the nation and the world. By skillfully employing social media and circulating viral video of police abuse, the Occupy Wall Street model of protest encampments has spread to more than a dozen cities across the U.S. Occupations of public spaces have been organized in Los Angeles, Chicago, Boston, and other cities large and small, with the number growing every day. Although activists gathered in New York and other cities don't as yet have a comprehensive list of demands, those involved clearly have a common set of beliefs focused on resistance to unbridled corporate greed, facilitated by a corrupt political system linked to a call for accountability. Your reporter visited the protest site at Zuccotti Park in Lower Manhattan's financial district on October 1st and interviewed one of the Occupy Wall Street organizers, who goes by the name of Joe Hill, just before he and hundreds of others were arrested on the Brooklyn Bridge. Here he talks about the origins and future direction of what appears to many observers to be the foundation of a new national economic and social justice movement.
About a month ago, some of us got together and formed the New York City General Assembly and began to make groundwork and planning for the hopes that we would be able to claim a space in the financial district to raise a critique about what's happened in the economic system and to build a movement to fight back against the consolidation of wealth.
What did you envision back before September 17th and the beginning of the occupation, and compare that maybe to what actually has happened in the couple of weeks since?
Well, I've been hoping for 20 years now, but most recently with the last crash, that people would begin to fight back. But frankly, I thought that we wouldn't last more than a couple days and that we would be cleared out by Monday and that there wouldn't be enough people to maintain the strength of this space. And so I didn't expect that we would last more than a couple days, but hope that we would.
So what's been your impression of how this has taken off, not just here in New York City, but there are other groups forming around the country with similar occupations happening or being planned?
My impression is that this is the most exciting moment in my adult life. I've been working for social justice in various capacities for 20 years and have never seen the excitement and enthusiasm that's taking place right here and across the country. And I think a lot of that is due to the method of organizing that's being employed here, which is, you know, not having slogans and cookie-cutter approaches that can be quickly co-opted by anybody, be it the Democratic Party or a trade union, but rather it's individuals and people who may or may not be part of groups coming together to find common solutions and common ground, which has really struck a nerve with people who, you know, don't have other avenues of protest. And that the process itself is exciting. Of course, it's based on things that have happened in other countries, including Spain, Greece, and North Africa, you know, and people are really serious about this. This is not a ragtag group of people who don't know what they're doing. Most people have read quite a bit about the other movements and are actually employing those tactics and strategies so that we can grow and build the kind of movement it's going to take the country back.
As you were planning this before September 17th and the occupation began, were you consciously trying to formulate something here that would go beyond a simple protest and actually be the seeds for the start of a movement?
Absolutely. Some of the feedback I got from people that I invited to this is, why are you doing it on a Saturday? And I would explain that this isn't a demonstration, this is an occupation, and most people move into new houses on a Saturday, and so that it's a day that we could begin the movement, but wasn't going to be a one-day protest. The days of being able to effectively have a one-day symbolic protest and affect policy are in our past. What we need to do is actually have a sustained resistance.
Where do you see this thing heading in the next few weeks to long-range future? You know, people talk about camping out here in the middle of January when it's, you know, below zero or 20 degrees and a lot of wind and snow. What do you see happening?
I think the commitment and the conditions that most of these people are facing by being unemployed, by coming out with massive student debt, will keep this thing going for the long haul. I'm not sure exactly what sort of shape it will take, but I certainly think that what started here is not going to stop anytime soon. I hope that the encampment can stay throughout the winter, but the ultimate goal isn't just to hold and occupy this space. The goal is to create a platform by which we can begin a resistance against the 1%. And that's already happened, and the contacts and connections that people have been making in this square will last beyond this square, and the tactics and things that we're all learning from each other are things that will help us get through winter, and certainly will be around in the spring and summer, and really, frankly, if you talk to people here, they're saying it's as long as it takes, and I believe that. I believe that that's the overwhelming sentiment of people here.
Beyond the occupation and the symbolism it represents and the hope it represents for people who want to take the tact of resistance, what concretely do you want to have come out of this thing in terms of, a change in policy or presenting policy alternatives and then making demands to invoke them?
I mean, I don't think that change in policy is in the cards with the way that our government is structured, be it money in politics or be it the two parties that are acting for the same class of people, that we're not thinking, I'm not, and many people here aren't thinking about it as any sort of short-term policy fix. So we don't want to get behind a health care for all banner that turns into health care for everybody from 19 to 26 years old. We don't want to get behind some, you know, employee free choice act that ends up people don't get collective bargaining and then hear great speeches for some great candidate. That's not where it's going. In terms of the concrete things that could happen, those are happening. People are learning how to feed each other, people are learning how to take care of each other, and people are learning how to share skills. And frankly, creating a new democracy and a new economy in a small square in the heart of the old economy. And so when we get a new economic system in this country, I don't know, but it seems to be happening faster than I thought it would have happened. If you look at mainstream labor unions endorsing this action and people coming in off the street, this thing is growing quicker than any of us had hoped. And we take a long vision for how the change can happen, and it's happening one person at a time.
That was Joe Hill, an organizer with the Occupy Wall Street protest encampment. Find links to more information on this new economic justice movement by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. This week, 4,200 inmates in California prisons are on hunger strike, many in solidarity with prisoners at the Pelican Bay Super Maximum Security Facility. Prisoners at Pelican Bay conducted an earlier hunger strike over the summer, but called it off when they believed prison officials would grant some of their demands. Their demands included ending group punishment and administrative abuse, abolishing the debriefing policy, which pressures inmates to provide information on the gang status of fellow inmates, ending long-term solitary confinement, providing adequate and nutritious food, and offering constructive programming and privileges for those held indefinitely in supermax custody. When it became apparent that prison officials would not enact substantive changes, prisoners began a second hunger strike on September 29th and were joined by inmates at other state prisons across California. Through a method of communication supporters on the outside either don't know or aren't talking about. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Amy Fettig, senior staff counsel with the American Civil Liberties Union's National Prison Project. She discusses the inhumane conditions at Pelican Bay with a focus on solitary confinement, considered by Amnesty International and other groups to be a form of torture.
This protest arises from a number of things, but its chief concern is extended solitary confinement for not months, not years, but sometimes decades, for men that are almost completely isolated from other human beings, who are kept in almost complete idleness, so they have nothing to do, nothing to fill their time, and have no way to actually get out of the conditions that they are subject to. They can't earn their way out. They're basically trapped in this limbo state with no means to solve their problems other than to try to get the world to pay greater attention by starving themselves.
Is this how all of them are treated in the Supermax? I remember when the Supermax prisons came online a couple of decades ago, that was one of their defining characteristics, right? The prisoners are kept in solitary confinement just about all the time?
Yes, yeah. For on average, 24 hours a day of complete social isolation. This means you don't get to interact with other human beings. You have your meals in your cell. You rarely ever leave your cell. You rarely have access to visiting anyone. And when you go outside for what may be called recreation, you are in a cage by yourself. So that is a level of isolation that is almost impossible for your average American to even imagine.
Amnesty International and many other groups, including mental health professionals, have defined this as torture.
Yes, as has bodies in the United Nations. In fact, all the research that has been done for years and decades has found that these types of conditions impact human beings in extreme ways. For folks who have mental illness to begin with, this will no doubt, being subject to these conditions, cause that individual to become sicker and sicker. But conditions of extreme isolation also have incredible impacts on folks who came into the system without mental illness. It literally makes you mentally ill. So there are some real questions about subjecting individuals to this type of isolation, especially when we're looking not at days or months, but years and even decades.
You were talking about them starving themselves to death, but I'm sure before things got that far, they would be force-fed, no? Did that happen in the first round of the hunger strike earlier this year?
You know, I'm not aware if it got that far in the last round. Certainly it went on. The initial round was 3 weeks. And the policy would be to force feed an individual before he or she actually expired. However, you get to a real state of a degradation in your health when you're talking about starving yourself for such a long period of time. So these are very risky things to do. They're causing a great deal of harm. But I think you have to look at what the options are for these prisoners, especially now when they, you know, back in July, they reached out to prison officials, they went on strike, it looked like there would be some real negotiations, and what we can see from this next strike is that the prisoners really felt that they weren't being listened to, they weren't being dealt with fairly, and that they had no other options.
Amy Fettig, has Governor Jerry Brown weighed in on this at all? In his first stint as governor in the 1970s, he was avowedly liberal with a spiritual streak. It seems like these conditions wouldn't sit well with him.
I know that he has expressed an opinion, quite frankly, but I would hope as the leader of the state and someone who is currently engaged in prison reform, given the problems that are now endemic in the California system, that he would take a real interest in this because it's a red flag. It should tell all officials in California that there's something seriously wrong in their prisons and that they need to take some action.
Pelican Bay is a supermax, but the hunger strike has spread to other facilities that are not supermax. If someone isn't already in isolation and starts resisting state authority by going on a hunger strike, are they then put into isolation?
My understanding is that prison officials are now saying that they are going to crack down on the hunger strikers, regardless of whether or not they're in Pelican Bay or another facility, that essentially they're going to get tough now. And I would say this is exactly the wrong reaction to have. Rather than sitting down and engaging in good faith negotiations and realizing that thousands of prisoners don't start starving themselves to death for no reason, that this is the time to take some serious action and reflect on their policies and procedures here, rather than burying their head in the sand yet further. They need to change the way they do business. And frankly, other states already have. Using long-term isolation has unfortunately become a pervasive practice in this country. However, increasingly states are recognizing that not only does it yield bad results because it has detrimental psychological impacts on people when they're released to the community, they have higher recidivism rates, and quite frankly, it costs 200 to 300% more to hold people in these types of prisons. So it's really a lose-lose. and what we're seeing in places like Mississippi and Colorado, the state of Maine, New Mexico, is that state legislators are taking a second look at what has been happening in corrections because it's costing taxpayers millions and millions of dollars and it's producing lousy results. And on top of that, it's inhumane.
That was Amy Fettig of the ACLU's National Prison Project. For more information on the California prisoner hunger strike and a petition calling for an end to extended solitary confinement, visit our website at btlonline.org. Despite an international campaign and petition drive that collected nearly 1 million signatures to stop his execution, 41-year-old Troy Davis was put to death by lethal injection in a Georgia prison on September 21st. In the weeks before the execution, Amnesty International, which has long campaigned against the death penalty, helped organize 300 vigils and other events in an attempt to pressure Georgia state authorities to commute Troy Davis's death sentence. Although the campaign did not succeed, opponents of capital punishment were heartened by the widespread public attention focused on grave questions surrounding the guilt of Troy Davis. His supporters maintained that there was no physical evidence linking Davis to the 1989 murder of Savannah police officer Mark McPhail. The guilty verdict that put Davis on death row in 1991 was the subject of more uncertainty after 7 of 9 witnesses who testified that Davis was the killer recanted their testimony, declaring that they were pressured by law enforcement to wrongly identify Davis. Your reporter spoke with Richard Dieter, executive director of the Death Penalty Information Center, whose organization provides analysis and information on issues relating to capital punishment. Here he explains why he believes that the national debate and protests that focused on opposition to the execution of Troy Davis could strengthen the movement to abolish the death penalty in the U.S.
Well, I've been in my job here at the Death Penalty Information Center since 1992. Before then, I worked on the death penalty in other places, and this was the largest and most deeply felt reaction to an execution that I have seen in that time. You know, I was in Washington that evening. People were demonstrating in front of the White House and at the Supreme Court at the same time. Students were coming out of universities onto the streets. It was quite amazing. Of course, there were bigger demonstrations in Georgia, in Atlanta, and at the prison. And we were hearing from people in London and Paris, what can we do? That sort of thing. All day long we had calls. We really don't know what people can do. That's sort of, as I say, our role is more informational. But, you know, it was that frustration, I think, that people felt that something was approaching that was wrong, and they didn't know what to do. They felt there ought to be something that a society like ours can do to stop it, and it wasn't stopped. And so, you know, it was an amazing example or display that the death penalty is got a lot of people who are objecting to it, either in theory or, you know, in principle, or at least for this case. I think it was just a large combination of people. It wasn't everybody wasn't saying the same thing. There were people saying this execution should be stopped, or people are saying the death penalty was wrong. You know, they're coming at it from different perspectives, but it really touched a chord, and I think we're going to see some changes because of it.
So what changes do you think are likely to occur as a result of the national debate, the dialogue, the media focus on the protests and the questions that revolved around Troy Davis's guilt at the time of his execution?
We have a long tradition in our country of proof beyond a reasonable doubt at trial, and that's the way it was in the Troy Davis case. But after trial, that's not the standard anymore. The assumption is you've been found guilty. And you've got to really mount a high wall to overturn that. And Troy Davis's lawyers and supporters, I think, were able to show that there was doubt, certainly reasonable doubt, but that wasn't enough to stop the execution. And that's where I think people felt frustrated. So our system has a hole in it, or the death penalty is not fitting, and you know, one solution would be just not have the death penalty. Short of that, I think there has to be some standard, whether it be that courts would be mandated by a change in the law, that if there's reasonable doubt, but, you know, executions cannot go forward and sentences will be reduced, or that the standard for getting the death penalty at the original trial will have to be even higher than it is now, which is the regular beyond a reasonable doubt. So it's really actually not that easy to say what the changes are, but certainly people want something changed, and if the death penalty can't be made to fit within our system, then maybe the death penalty is going to be stopped.
Public opinion in this country has been fairly consistent in its support of the death penalty, but there was a point during a recent Republican presidential candidate debate when the moderator asked Governor Rick Perry about his record number of execution orders. I believe it exceeded 230 during his time as governor, and the audience exploded in cheers. It brought up a lot of questions about the ugly side of America, where there's some kind of cheerleading for death among certain people of a political persuasion. Where do you see public opinion headed in terms of the death penalty? Is the audience during that debate representative of America as a whole?
No, I don't think so. I don't think that I would even say they were representative of a clamor for death. I think that was a purely a political moment at which their coach, their player, was being challenged, and they rose up in support. And the death penalty is mostly symbolic. It's mostly political in this country. It has very little to do with the criminal justice system or a rational way of punishing. You know, the numbers just don't bear it out. Most of the countries in the world are now doing away with the death penalty. A quarter or a third of our states don't have it at all. And matter of fact, almost all our states rarely use it. So we're moving that way, despite the cheers. That's my belief.
That was Richard Dieter, Executive Director of the Death Penalty Information Center. Learn more about the debate on capital punishment by visiting our website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.